All right, good morning, everybody. Bio 231, and it's Monday, May 4th. Okay, so we're sort of in the middle of the respiratory chapter, and we'll finish that today and move on to digestive system. And let's see, open lab. The only time I can get an open lab in for you guys for the last practicum is tonight from 5 till 7. And I don't know of anybody else that can do it, so let everybody know. I'll send emails out, but it's just a little bit late to send emails out. Anybody going to come? Nobody? Couple people? All right. I'll be there 5 to 7, just a couple hours. Can't do it tomorrow because we got to set up the test tomorrow. And if I have open lab tomorrow and then set it up, I don't get done till like 11 o'clock or midnight, and then I got to go do other stuff, and then I'm just too tired the rest of the week. So, yeah. The room, that's right, because 335 is booked. It's going to be in 317. 317, I think that's right by the elevator. Room 317. So step out of the elevator, it's going to be just right on the right-hand side. So that's it for the whole week. Yeah. Yep. Okay. Right. So any questions on respiratory system? Okay. We were talking about surface area last time. And what's the structure inside the lungs that increases the surface area for exchange? The alveoli, yeah. And it's the shape of the alveolus. Remember, an alveolus is this little berry-shaped structure, and if we flatten them all out, what is the surface area for exchange? If we flatten each one out, all 300 million, flatten them out, put them on a table, how big would that table have to be? Yeah, half the size of a tennis court, so that's huge. 70 square meters. All right, and when I say surface area, what is the layman's term that you should use to think of surface area? What does surface area really mean? It means, yeah, it's an area for gas to move in and out of your body, like oxygen moving in, CO2 moving out. All right, but I think last time I grabbed a ruler and I measured something.
Door.
I measured a door. That's right, so surface area, I want you to remember as a doorway for things to enter or leave your body. So what about that size of half of a tennis court? Is that a big doorway or a little doorway?
Large.
Oh, it's a huge doorway. We could probably get 100 people through a doorway that size at one time. All right, so that's a really big surface area. Yeah. Mechanics of breathing? No, I'm going to go back to that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm going to go back to mechanics of breathing. Okay, so, okay. All right, so I want to talk about the respiratory membrane after I turn some of these lights off so I can see what's going on. Ooh, too dark. All right, that's as best as I can see it. Okay, so the respiratory membrane is, which way does it go? Thought I had it all lined up. Respiratory membrane. Okay, so the respiratory membrane are all the structures and layers that oxygen has to diffuse across to get from air in an alveolus to get into a capillary. So on this illustration right here, we see an alveolus, right? And notice that the cells that make up the alveolus are type 1 cells. There's another type 2 alveolar cell, right? Which is right here and right here and right here. I'm going to talk about those in just a second. Actually, I'll say just a little bit about them. They secrete surfactant. And we'll see what the job of surfactant is in just a second. All right, and then here we have a capillary with red blood cells in it. So air has to move from, or oxygen from the within the alveolus has to move from the alveolus into a capillary. So this is the membrane that it has to go through if we zoom in to this region right here. All right, so let's start in the alveolus. The first thing that it has to diffuse across is a very small layer of surfactant. All right, so it's an aqueous solution of a chemical that's very, very slippery. And then it's got to move across the wall of the alveolus right here. Now, what kind of cell is that? That's a simple squamous, and the epithelium is a simple squamous epithelium, so it's a squamous cell. And then it has to move through a very thin layer of interstitial connective tissue, right? And then it has to move through the wall of the capillary. And what kind of epithelium makes a wall of a capillary? Again, a simple squamous epithelium, right? So it's specialized for exchange, and then that oxygen is in the blood. All right, so what's the job of this type 2 alveolar cell? We said that it makes surfactant. All right, so what the heck is surfactant? Well, what is the fluid that makes up most of our body? Okay, serous fluid. And what makes up most of serous fluid?
Water.
Yeah, so water. And when you think of water, is it sticky or is it slippery?
Slippery.
Slippery, sticky. I heard both, but I think I mostly heard, oh, it's slippery. Okay. Well, I want to change your impression on that a little bit. Okay, let's just pretend I got a couple, well, I do have a couple little sheets of plastic right here that I'll put together, and I'm going to hold one, I'm going to have you pull on the bottom one. Are they glued together?
No.
No, they just fell right apart. Okay, so let's glue them together. All right, so a lot of people said that water is slippery. I'm going to try to convince you that it's actually sticky, and I'm going to use water as a glue to glue those two pieces of paper together. All right, so I got some water on there. Glued them together. Did anybody see me put anything else on there besides water? No? Okay. Oh, now I got it stuck to the tabletop. All right. And now we're going to do pretty much the same kind of experiment again. Okay, so you just grab the bottom one. And could you see how sticky they were? Let's try that one more time. Right over here. Are they sticking together? Just pull the bottom straight down. Amazing how sticky things are, right? All right, and I'll do it one more time. Okay. Oh, that had too many air bubbles in there. It's due to surface tension. Okay, but nonetheless, if I hold it up like that, okay, you see that they don't fall down. All right, as a matter of fact, depending on how I hold it, it's really stuck together. All right, because water is sticky. Water molecules like to stick together. So, for instance, we have water molecules on one side of an alveolus over here, and we have water on the other side. If an alveolus were to collapse, right, you would never be able to inflate that alveolus again. It would stay collapsed, and you wouldn't be able to inhale, and you'd never get any oxygen in that alveolus and no oxygen in your body. And as a matter of fact, that's what happens to some premature babies. If they're born too premature, those type 2 alveolar cells don't have enough time to mature and secrete surfactant, and they can't inflate their lungs. All right, and then they have to be put in an oxygen tent to help them breathe. All right, so surfactant is very important. So that is the first part of the respiratory membrane right here that's lining the alveolus. And surfactant is just like a modified oily compound, almost like a soap, that allows the alveoli to inflate. Okay. The other thing I want to demonstrate for you is that, notice the capillary network around this alveolus right here, but what else do you see surrounding an alveolus? Okay, you see capillaries, but what else do you see surrounding an alveolus? Ah, you see elastic fibers. Okay, and those are real important because they always help compress the lungs. So when you breathe, when you inspire, let's talk about inspiration just a little bit. How do you inspire? All right, so here is the volume of the thoracic cavity. And here is the diaphragm. Notice how dome-shaped it is when it is relaxed. All right? And when we inhale, we contract the diaphragm so that it flattens out. So that increases the size of the thoracic cavity by this much. And when the volume of the thoracic cavity increases, the pressure decreases, and then air flows into the lungs as a result of that. There are some other things that increase the size of the thoracic cavity. Okay, and that is some muscles, the intercostal muscles. All right, so not only does the length from in the superior-inferior dimension of the thoracic cavity increase, but the external intercostals contract, and that increases the diameter from right to left as well. So your ribs lift up and out, and when that happens, the pressure inside your lungs decreases and air flows inside your lungs. So that's important for inspiration. So you have to know the muscles for inspiration, which are the diaphragm and the external intercostals. Okay, so for inspiration, we've got the diaphragm and the external intercostals for inspiration. When you're breathing quietly, like what you're doing right now, you're not hyperventilating. Okay, now what about for expiration? For expiration, it's a whole lot different. You don't need muscles to expire air. There's enough elastic tissue in the diaphragm so that when the diaphragm relaxes, guess what it does? It goes back to this location, and that forces air out of your lungs. There's something else that has a lot of elastic tissue in the lungs, and what's that? Where else do you find elastic tissue in the lungs? Trachea has cartilage, so it doesn't really contract, all right? But where else did you see it? Around every alveolus. There's an elastic network around every alveolus. So when you expand the alveoli, when you inhale, when you relax the diaphragm, guess what that elastic tissue does? It causes the alveolus to collapse, all right? So exhalation is completely passive, which means that you don't need any muscle to contract to exhale under relaxed breathing kinds of conditions. All right? Unlike inspiration, of course, you need muscles to contract. What muscles do you need to contract for inspiration? Diaphragm and the external intercostals for inspiration. All right, so I got a couple models here, a couple different items that I'm going to use to model an alveolus. And you got to tell me which one is a better model of an alveolus. All right, so first I have a paper bag right here, and just think that it's one of those 300 million alveoli you have in your lungs. And we're going to inflate it, all right, so we're going to contract the diaphragm, and guess what's going to happen to this alveolus right here? It's going to expand, right? Okay, so I expanded this paper bag, so I've got all that air in there, and I said, well, expiration is just passive, you just relax. So if I relax my hand holding the air in the bag, what's going to happen to the bag? Is it going to shrink down?
No.
Is it going to stay there? Okay, I'm going to make sure there's a passageway. And look, it's not changing shape. So could that person exhale?
No.
Do you have any elastic tissue in that alveolus right there?
No.
So that person has trouble breathing, right? Can't exhale. All right, so here we have a balloon. Let's see if I can inflate the balloon. Okay, oh, I did. It didn't pop. That's good. Okay. Oops, sorry. All right, so here is our second model of an alveolus. What does it have around there? Well, it's got the capillaries pretend, but for sure it's got what? The elastic material around it. So now what happens if I relax? What happens? What happens to this alveolus right here? Oops. What's wrong? Oh, I did something funny to it. Okay, well, it collapsed, just not as dramatic as I thought it would. Okay. I got it back. Okay. All right, so the lung relaxes. All right, and then there we go. That's what I wanted to show you. Okay, so exhalation for normal quiet breathing is what? Passive. You don't need muscles to exhale. As long as you have, what, normal lung tissue that has the elastic component around it. Okay. So that's a little bit about the mechanics of breathing, the surfactant that's necessary. Now, the only other thing that's important is that you have another kind of breathing, and that is when you breathe forcefully, you need to move more air in and out of your lungs. All right, so the muscles that are used for inspiration are the diaphragm and external intercostals, just like for quiet breathing, but some others, like the sternocleidomastoid and the scalenes, help lift up the rib cage. That's for inspiration, all right, two additional muscles. And then for forced exhalation, when you want to exhale very quickly, you use all of your abdominal skeletal muscles. So the rectus abdominis, all right, and then what are some others in the stomach? Internal oblique, external oblique, and transverse abdominis all compress the abdominal contents up into the thoracic cavity, expelling air. All right, so you use different muscles for different things. Like when you're exercising, for instance, right? Or if you're singing or playing a wind instrument or something and you need to expel more air out of your body. So anytime you're doing any kind of activity. Okay, so forced breathing. Okay, that's good. All right, so let's talk about control of breathing. Control of breathing is occurring in the respiratory center. And the respiratory center is in the medulla and a little bit of the pons. Where are those located at? In the brain stem, right? So the respiratory center controls the rate and depth of respiration. The ventral respiratory group is the pacemaker of breathing. That means that it establishes the normal breathing rhythm. And then these other centers help adjust the pacemaker, like the dorsal respiratory group and the pontine respiratory center, help adjust the rhythm of the pacemaker to meet the demands of the body, but also to make sure that you don't overinflate your lungs, because a person's lung can be damaged by overinflating. All right, so somewhere as you're inhaling, inhalation is going to be inhibited so that you don't overstretch your lungs. All right, and then the medulla oblongata, or the respiratory center, sends information to the diaphragm that causes it to contract. And what's the diaphragm going to do? What's it going to cause? Inspiration, right? Diaphragm causes inspiration. And how do signals get from the respiratory center to the diaphragm? What's the name of that nerve? And we made a big deal of that already. That's the phrenic nerve. What's the origin of the phrenic nerve? C3, 4, and 5 keeps you alive, right? So it goes through the cervical nerve plexus and then to the diaphragm. All right, so what controls respiration? Well, your body is monitoring things all the time. There are chemoreceptors in the arch of the aorta. And then what do we call this area right here, this little bulge at the bifurcation of the common carotid to the internal and external carotid arteries? What is that thing called? That little bulge right there. That's called the carotid. I mean, it's not labeled?
Carotid body?
Carotid sinus. All right, so the little bulge, the little ampule-like in the bifurcation right here, that's called the carotid sinus. And there you have the carotid bodies that can monitor oxygen and CO2 and pH. Okay? And then these will send signals to the respiratory center. All right, so those are the major centers. So chemoreceptors, you have central receptors and peripheral receptors. I just showed you where the peripheral receptors are. Carotid sinus and the arch of the aorta. All right, the central receptors, and when we say central, what does that mean? Central nervous system. Right, when we use the word central, we really usually mean central nervous system. All right, there are receptors, chemoreceptors, and so what does a chemoreceptor sense? Chemicals, right? For instance, like CO2 and pH. pH is just a measure of a hydrogen ion or acidity of our brains. All right, and these central receptors are in the medulla oblongata and the pons.
Okay. Did I ask a question about that?
Yeah.
So you're saying that the carbon dioxide increases and the pH decreases, right?
They go hand in hand. Okay. Yes. Yes. They go hand in hand, and there's an enzyme that interconverts those, but in this class, I don't think we have to know the enzyme that interconverts hydrogen ion with CO2. But as CO2 builds up on our body, we become a lot more acidic. So our pH decreases. All right. So if for whatever reason we're exercising very strenuously and CO2 goes up, or maybe we're not breathing, all right, CO2 goes up, that decreases pH, and that increase in CO2 and decrease in pH stimulates the respiratory center to increase ventilation to get that CO2 out of our body. So we'll start to hyperventilate as a result of that. So if you were to hold your breath for a little while, maybe for 20 seconds, guess what would happen to levels of CO2 in your body? They would increase because you're producing CO2 just by staying alive, making ATP. And as CO2 increases, the pH of your body is going to decrease, right? And what's going to happen to you? You're going to have an urge to breathe. When that CO2 goes up, the pH goes down. So that when you start breathing again, what is that going to be like? Are you going to be breathing very slowly? Or what's going to be happening to you? You're going to have a sense that you should be breathing rapidly, right? You're going to be hyperventilating as a result. Okay, those peripheral receptors in the carotid sinus and aortic arch are more sensitive to oxygen than they are these other chemicals. And they're relatively insensitive. It's the chemoreceptors in the medulla that do most of the work. But if for whatever reason, okay, you stop breathing, after a relatively short period of time, oxygen concentration is going to be really depleted in your body. Under those conditions, the peripheral receptors will stimulate the respiratory center to increase ventilation. But it's only when oxygen decreases drastically do you have that urgency to breathe, okay, due to the peripheral receptors. Okay, so the peripheral receptors are sensitive only to large changes in decreases in oxygen. All right, and this is kind of funny, I think, because before I took a physiology or anatomy class, I thought, well, our respiratory system really should be keyed on how much oxygen we have in our bodies, right? Because you need oxygen to make ATP, but that's not the case. The case is that your body really pays attention to CO2 levels, the byproduct of making ATP. All right, so CO2 and pH. And then the higher centers can affect breathing as well, like the cerebral cortex. You have voluntary control over all those muscles, because indeed all those muscles are skeletal muscles, so you can hold your breath. And did anybody pay any dirty tricks on their parents when you were growing up? What could you really do if you really wanted to scare somebody? You could hold your breath until you passed out, okay, because your conscious control can override those skeletal muscles. All right, but that's not such a big deal, because what happens after you pass out? Your medulla oblongata takes over and you start breathing normally again, probably hyperventilating a little bit, and then oxygen goes back to your brain and you just wake up from that. All right, so passing out by holding your breath is not really such a big deal. And you could do it right now if you wanted to, but it wouldn't freak me out. Well, maybe it would. Don't try it.
What is it on professional swimmers that they can hold their breath?
Oh, this is sort of interesting. The question is, why are professional swimmers or divers able to hold their breath for such a long time? Well, with practice, right, we can improve the function of our bodies in a number of different ways. But one trick that, for instance, divers do, and sometimes it's a little bit dangerous. Do we have any free divers that like to go fishing out on the ocean without scuba tanks? They can dive really deep, 30 feet is no problem, and stay underwater for a minute, maybe 2 minutes, something like that. Okay. Well, this is a trick that they do. What did I say was the most powerful stimulus for giving you the urge to breathe? And of course, when you're 30 feet under the surface, you don't want to breathe. Okay, so here it is. You are 100% right. Increased carbon dioxide is going to give you that urgency to breathe. So how can you deplete your body of carbon dioxide before you dive underwater? You can hyperventilate. Okay? So you can hyperventilate. You can get rid of a lot of CO2 even right now. Right? You could hyperventilate and you can hold your breath for a lot longer period of time. Maybe twice as long if you really hyperventilate, because all that CO2 leaves your blood and now there's no signal to your respiratory center to take a breath, which is really handy. Except this is a problem that they can get into. Yeah? This is a problem that they can get into. When you hyperventilate, you don't really increase the amount of oxygen in your blood. The amount of oxygen pretty much is always 100% when it's leaving your lungs. So when you hyperventilate, you get rid of this signal to breathe, right? And then people dive, and they don't have an urgency to breathe, don't have an urgency to breathe, don't have an urgency to breathe, but what are they using up? They're using up all the oxygen in their body, right? Their heart is still beating, but what happens when the brain uses up all that oxygen that's in their blood? Even though they don't have an urgency to breathe because all that carbon dioxide is gone, what do? They pass out. Okay? Now, that's normally not such a bad deal as long as you don't hit your head on the table and then the floor if you pass out. But if you're underwater and you pass out, what's going to happen? Well, then you drown. Okay? So that's kind of a side effect that people have to really pay close attention to, and some people don't appreciate that until after they're dead, unfortunately. So that's kind of interesting. Okay? I'm glad you mentioned that. I didn't want to take time to talk about that, but that's pretty interesting. All right, so the higher centers can make you hold your breath, all right? And, of course, your hypothalamus is controlled to the rest of your brain. So, for instance, any kind of emotional stimulus can change your respiratory rate. Like for right now, I could say, well, I'm going to have a pop quiz right now. So that's an emotional stimulus to you, and what would happen to your respiratory rate, if you believe me? It would probably increase, right? Okay. Well, I'm just kidding. All right. So higher centers can affect your respiratory rate. Also, proprioceptors. What's a proprioceptor? Okay. That's a general sense that you have at all your muscles and joints that tell your cerebellum and your brain what body position you're in and how much tension are in muscles and whether your body is moving, all right, especially in joints. So even right now when you're sitting down, are you exercising right now? Well, not much. You're just sitting there pretty much passively. You're exercising your brain, okay? All right. Exercising, I mean like walking up a flight of stairs or something. What would happen to your respirations when you start to walk up the stairs? They increase because those muscles are producing a lot of CO2. Okay, now let's just say you're sitting in your chair, not exercising very much, and then all of a sudden you move your knee by moving your leg very easily back and forth and maybe your elbows, and you're not lifting any weight, so you're not really exercising. You're not producing a lot of CO2, but just that motion right there is going to stimulate proprioceptors. Proprioceptors are going to send information to higher centers in the brain. And guess what you're going to experience even though you're not really exercising? You're going to experience an urgency to breathe just by moving joints around almost passively in your body. Okay. Well, what are some other things? Other receptors like touch, pain, temperature. If I poke you with a pin, guess what would happen to your respiratory rate? It would increase. All right. What about temperature? If I were to take an ice cube and put it on the back of your neck, what would happen to you? Okay, your respiratory rate would increase, but something else might happen too. You might actually go, right? We call that a gasp reflex when something cold is touching you. And actually, that causes a number of drownings all over the place. When somebody falls into, like for instance, a good example would be, what's the ocean like around here? Is it nice and warm?
Cold.
It's cold. Let's just say you went fishing out on the ocean and you slipped off the boat by accident into the ocean, and how would that feel? That'd be really cold. And as that cold water hit you, guess what the normal reflex of your body is to do? Gasp, namely. And that's really dangerous because you're in the ocean, and if your head is underwater, what are you breathing into your lungs? Water. And again, you could drown very easily as a result of that. Okay, so all these things can influence the respiratory center in the medulla oblongata. Okay, and I think that's all I want to talk about in terms of the respiratory system. Okay, yeah. Okay. The lungs are lined on the outside, which is called the pleural membrane. Pleural membrane. Anytime you hear pleural, you should think of lungs. And it's a serous membrane, so how many different layers are there? Yeah, there are three. So, wow, I'm having a hard time seeing the screen. So let's see. Do we have a picture of the pleural membrane someplace? I think this is probably as good as it gets right here. All right, so here is the lung tissue itself. So here's the margin of the lung. And then here is one, this is the deepest layer of the pleural membrane that's right on the surface of the lung. And so that's called what? The visceral pleural membrane. And then here is the pleural cavity space, the serous cavity that's filled with fluid. Now this fluid is not like the fluid that's inside your lungs. This fluid is very sticky because it's made mostly out of water. So that's really important, and I'll get to that in a second. And then the most superficial layer, this one right here, that is the parietal pleural membrane. So you got parietal pleural membrane on the outside, the serous cavity, and then the visceral pleural membrane. All right, so the parietal pleura is attached to the wall of the thorax. All right, so don't forget, when you breathe, the wall of the thorax moves up and out. All right, and because the fluid in this pleural cavity right here is watery, it's very sticky, when the wall of the thorax expands, it pulls on the lung itself and expands the lung. Okay, and as the lung expands, the pressure decreases and air goes inside your lungs. So if in this pleural cavity right here, if there were surfactant, right, then that would just mean that the thoracic cavity could expand and contract without pulling on the lungs, and the lungs wouldn't even increase at all. They would just stay contracted because of that elastic tissue around every alveolus. All right, so the fluid inside the lungs has surfactant to allow the lungs to expand. The fluid in the serous cavity right here has no surfactant so that the wall of the thorax can actually pull on the surface of the lung to help expand it. So that's interesting. Okay, so you got probably even a nicer picture of that in your book. I'm not sure I have it in the slide. All right, so that's it for, yes, question. Yeah, okay, the airways. What airways have cartilage? Well, let's start with, there's nothing in the upper airways, that's just the mouth and nasal cavity, but in terms of the lower airway, you've got the larynx, all right, and you should probably know the cartilages that make up the larynx. Like, what's the most prominent one here? Thyroid cartilage, right, then cricoid cartilage, arytenoid, corniculate cartilage, all right, and then from the larynx you get into the trachea, and the trachea's got C-shaped cartilages, except on the posterior side. There's no cartilage on the posterior side, there's a muscle on the posterior side of the trachea. What's that muscle called? The trachealis, and that allows for expansion of the esophagus, so when you swallow a bolus of food, right, so the trachealis can expand and let the bolus of food go into your stomach. And then the trachea bifurcates into a primary bronchus that has cartilage and a tertiary bronchus that has cartilage, right, and smaller bronchi, those all have cartilage. They're held open all the time. It's not until you get down into the terminal bronchioles that cartilage goes away. Okay. All right. So bronchioles don't contain cartilage. They contain smooth muscle. And that smooth muscle can constrict and dilate to allow for easier perfusion of air in and out of the lungs, or ventilation of air in and out of the lungs. All right, so larynx, trachea, bronchi have cartilage. Bronchioles and below don't have cartilage. Yes. A terminal bronchiole is a kind of bronchiole. Okay, kind of a bronchiole. So you have a respiratory. Here is a terminal bronchiole that's right on the end of a bronchus. Right, and a bronchiole doesn't have cartilage. A terminal bronchiole does not allow for gas exchange. But then every once in a while, as you get closer and closer to an alveolus, a bronchiole might have like a little half of an alveolus poking out of it, and that is a site for exchange. So those bronchioles that have a little piece of an alveolus coming off of them are called respiratory bronchioles. So because of that, exchange can take place there. And then they go into that respiratory bronchiole, gets smaller, becomes an alveolar duct, and then that feeds air right into that alveolar sac. And alveolus. Okay. All right, so don't forget about those type 2 cells right there. So that's what, those are the ones that contain cartilage, yeah. The alveoli have surfactant, but the pleural space, the pleural cavity does not. It's sticky, it just has water. And that's important because as your rib cage expands, since the pleural space doesn't have surfactant, it acts like glue. It glues itself to the surface of the lungs so that when you expand your rib cage, that does what? That pulls on the surface of the lungs to help expand the lungs so that you can breathe in. Okay, so no surfactant there. And you should have no air in there either. When somebody gets a hole in their chest and there's air that can fill into that pleural space, then that's going to uncouple the lining of the lung to the thoracic wall. And when you breathe in, air rushes in and then the lung collapses. Why does a lung collapse when you have a hole in your thoracic cavity? Why will a lung collapse? That's called a pneumothorax. Why does it collapse? Why does it have that natural tendency to collapse? Because of all the elastic fibers around all of those 300 million alveoli are causing that lung to collapse. It has to be glued to the wall of the thorax, and it's glued to it by just water, basically. Okay, the serous fluid is sticky because it's water. There's no surfactant in that. Yeah. The type 2 cells secrete surfactant. They secrete that little, like a soapy detergent-like material that allows the alveoli to expand. And without it, the alveoli would be all stuck together and you could never inhale. And the type 1 is the simple squamous cell that makes the wall of the alveolus. That doesn't secrete anything in there. The other thing that you have in there are macrophages, which is a kind of white blood cell that's running around gobbling up stuff all the time that doesn't belong there. Dust particles, H1N1, yeah. All that other kind of stuff. Okay, hopefully. All right. Any other questions on? Yeah, one more.
Just to repeat the question because I didn't put attention. Which one contains cartilage?
Oh, what contains cartilage? We got larynx, we got trachea, and bronchi. Okay. So don't forget, you got a number of different bronchi. You got primary, secondary, tertiary, and then if you wanted to know which it was, you'd have to count from the primary bronchus. And more important, you should know why do they have cartilage?
To maintain open
mouth. Yeah, to make sure that they're open all the time. Because sometimes you compress your chest when you're breathing forcefully, and if you're trying to breathe forcefully and you compress your chest, the last thing you want is that trachea to collapse, because then you couldn't get air out of your lungs. Right, so it's held open all the time. But what's the drawback to having that trachea held open all the time? You just get something on top of it and let it go, what happens? Falls right in, blocks that airway, and then you're dead unless somebody knows how to do a Heimlich maneuver on you, right? Or you're able to cough it up or something. Okay.
Now, in the one that's not as cavity, the lungs are lined with a serous membrane, are called that. What is the other
problem? Right on the lungs?
Yeah, it's over there.
That is the visceral pleural membrane. That's right on the lung tissue itself. Visceral pleura. Right? And I wish I could see these colors, but I don't know. Is it really dark blue or purple or something right there? That's the visceral pleural membrane. And then you have that space filled with pleural fluid, which is sticky. And then this is the parietal pleura. And it almost looks like the same color to me. It is? It's not. Well, okay. I thought I was doing good today. Oh, well. All right. So those are the three parts of that serous membrane. Okay. All right. So that's it for respiratory system. I guess I can leave that open. All right, so we're going to move on to digestive system. Oh, I have to adjust the projector. Digestive system. Okay, so let's talk about the components of the digestive system. All right, so you got the oral cavity, you got teeth, tongue, you got salivary glands that secrete mucus, that's a lubricant, all right, so that you can swallow a bolus of food, it doesn't get trapped in the esophagus on the way down into the stomach. And then the salivary glands also secrete salivary amylase. Amylase is an enzyme that can break down starch into simple sugars. So the beginning of digestion actually takes place in the mouth, but how much digestion takes place in the mouth, would you think? A lot or a little?
A little bit.
Only a little bit. Because why?
Because
yeah, you don't chew your food for 15 minutes before you swallow it, right? It's only usually a couple seconds. Yeah. The real function of the saliva,
yeah,
it acts as a lubricant, okay, so that food that you eat can slide down into your stomach, otherwise it would get stuck.
Is there any enzyme from that?
Yeah, there's salivary amylase, and there's also lysozyme, that's a bacteriostatic agent, all right, it's not important for digestion, but maybe it helps fight bacteria. And saliva, and it probably has some antibodies in it that help fight cavities from forming in your teeth, because people would get cavities from bacterial action around their teeth. So that helps flush away the bacteria. So it's part of your immune system because it just flushes bacteria through and out of your body as well. But the most important thing is lubricant, so that you can swallow something. Right? And of course you can imagine eating a saltine cracker or something without saliva, there would be no way you could even begin to swallow it, right? Okay. All right, and so then the pharynx is your throat. Food moves into the esophagus, then into the stomach, and then into the small intestine. Now, do you know what the stomach looks like compared to the small intestine? Does it look different? Yeah. Guess what that means? It probably has a much different kind of function, and we're going to talk about the functions of these different things today, too. All right, and then from the small intestine, it moves into the large intestine. Does the large intestine look different than the small intestine? Yeah, one's small, one's large, right? Again, there's a connotation of different function there. And then there's some other organs associated with digestion, namely the pancreas, liver, and gallbladder that we're going to talk about. Okay. Well, first you have to know something about the layers of the intestines. And this is really important because there are a lot of disease processes of the digestive tract. And there's one that's very deadly. And I wish I could remember how many people die every year from this particular cancer. Probably at least 20,000 in the United States. For instance, that would be colon cancer or large intestinal cancer. And that's really a shame. We're going to talk about that when we get to the large intestine. That's really a shame. Does anybody know why I think that's really a shame that anybody dies of colon cancer, much less tens of thousands of people? Because it's 100% curable if it's caught early. Okay? It's 100% curable. So it just means lack of prevention. All right? Why is it caused? So there's improper diet, lack of exercise, genetic predisposition, maybe a lack of calcium in our diet. So again, probably mostly everything can be reduced down to, in its most simplest terms, diet and exercise. Okay, diet and exercise. So low calorie diet, but then probably if you have a genetic predisposition too. If anybody else in your family has had colon cancer, then you have a much higher risk. And then you should be really serious about that particular disease. So anyway, the way that we stage that disease to know how to treat it, all right, is by knowing something about the layers that make up the digestive tract. And of course, these layers all have a different function. Okay, arrow. Thank goodness. Here's my arrow back again. All right, so the deepest layer is called the mucosa. It's made up of an epithelium. It's stratified squamous, or in different parts of the digestive tract, it's a simple columnar epithelium. The lamina propria, that's loose connective tissue. It has glands and capillaries, and it also has a special little vessel that can absorb lipids. Guess what that little vessel is? We talked about it, I'm sure. That's a lacteal, right? There's a lacteal. All right, and it also has a little bit of muscle in there as well, so it can move around. Certain parts of the mucosa can move around. The next layer is the submucosa. This is a layer right underneath the mucosa. Again, a loose connective tissue that has larger arteries, veins, and a lot of lymphatic vessels. And it has muscles in it as well, and nerves. We call that the submucosal plexus. So when you think of your brain, you think your brain has a lot of nervous tissue, a lot of neurons in it? Mm-hmm. Would you think that there is probably more neurons there than anywhere else in your body? Mm-hmm. Okay, I would have a tendency to think so, but you know what? You have even more neurons in your digestive tract than you do in your brain and spinal cord. And that's because it makes up this submucosal plexus for controlling how you're digesting material and how material is moving through your digestive tract. All right, and then there's a muscle layer that is even superficial to this, yeah?
So that pretty much means that the intestine doesn't move by itself, right?
It moves by itself. It's regulated a little bit by other activity, but it is autorhythmic. It can control itself to a large degree. And as a matter of fact, for years and years and years, people used to think that our intestine actually controlled the rest of our body, was the central nervous system of our body, because there's so many nerves there. All right, but now we know that's not true. What controls our body? It's our brain and spinal cord. Okay, so yeah, digestive tract can take care of itself to a large degree. The muscularis layer has an inner circular smooth muscle and an outer longitudinal smooth muscle layer. And again, a huge myenteric plexus. All right, this is nerves that control these different layers of the muscularis externa. And it has inputs from the parasympathetic nervous system and the sympathetic nervous system. And which of these, and I'm talking about parasympathetic or sympathetic, which one promotes digestion and which one inhibits? Yeah, and this is strange because usually you think sympathetic is always going to be stimulatory, but that's not so on the digestive tract. It works oppositely, okay? So sympathetic is inhibitory on digestion, parasympathetic is stimulatory. And if you're ever going to try to figure out an easy way to remember that, just always think of that fight or flight mechanism. And I think we talked about that. Fight or flight is when you're presented with a very harmful stimulus. It's how your body gears up to deal with that stimulus by increasing respiratory rate, pupil dilation, increased heart rate, right? Increased blood flow to muscles so that you can run or fly away, and decrease activity to your gastrointestinal tract, because when you're about ready to die, you don't need to be wasting a lot of energy on digesting food. Okay? So that's a really easy way to try to remember that. And then the outer layer is what we call the serosa. That's just a slippery membrane because your intestines are slipping and sliding around inside your abdominal and pelvic cavity all the time. All right, so here is a nice picture of what the digestive system looks like, starting with the oral cavity, the pharynx. You've got a number of salivary glands, the esophagus bringing food down into the stomach, and then from the stomach into the small intestine, and then from small intestine into the large, and then eliminated out of your body. Okay? I know what we're talking about. Layers. Here are the layers. Right? So here you can see the mucosa, submucosa, right? And here's a little bit of the muscularis. And then you can see the muscularis interna, and then the serosa on the outside. Okay, and I think you have a pretty good model in lab that shows all of this kind of stuff as well. All right, motility. How does food move through your digestive tract? There are two main ways. All right, there is something called peristalsis, and there's something called segmentation. Peristalsis is the way that food moves in an antegrade direction. Antegrade means from, it means forward. Okay, mean mouth to anus. So it goes one direction, and it has to go through all the different parts of the intestine for all of the particular functions. All right, so it propels materials from one part of the digestive tract to the other in a coordinated and controlled fashion because of contraction of circular and longitudinal smooth muscle. And you should know what layer that's in. Segmentation, on the other hand, is a chopping or a churning kind of motion that is made up of antegrade and retrograde motion. So food is chopped up into smaller and smaller pieces. So this is more like a mixing motion that mixes the food up that we've eaten with, for instance, maybe gastric juice for digestion in the stomach and other kinds of enzymes that are going to be secreted in the small intestine. All right, so your book has pretty good examples of these different kinds of motions. So, for instance, if we have circular muscles contracting and it moves as a wave down the digestive tract, here's a bolus of food, and it's just going to be squished antegrade from one part of the intestine to the other. As opposed to if both the longitudinal and circular muscles contract, for instance, if we have a part of the intestinal tract that's undergoing segmentation, here we have a bolus of food, right? And if this area contracts right here, what happens? Then that food is, part of the food is going to end up here and the other part's going to end up over here, right? And then if this part contracts, then these two areas are going to be mixed together, giving you like this intermediate color right here. So this is a mixing or churning kind of motion. And this bolus of food doesn't make any transit through the digestive tract. It just gets mixed up, and that's what we call segmentation. All right, so let's talk about the stomach. All right? Yeah. Retrograde means backwards. Antegrade means forwards. Retrograde means backwards. Retrograde is mixing. Retrograde is going to be used for mixing, but for instance, yeah, if you vomit, that's big time retrograde flow, right? That's not antegrade flow. Okay, I won't tell any gross stories. Yeah. Yeah, where's the sign-in sheet at? Go ahead, raise your hand if you have the sign-in sheet and pass it. Yeah, pass it down to the front. Yeah, thank you. Okay. Yeah, so segmentation is a step forward and a step, half a step back, maybe something like that. Yeah. So it's just sharing and mixing components of the digestive tract. All right, so functions of the stomach. Okay, the most important functions are for storing and mixing. All right, what kind of motility is involved with mixing?
Segmentation.
Yeah, you're going to see segmentation in the stomach. All right, there's a little initial protein digestion with an enzyme called pepsin, and the stomach also secretes hydrochloric acid. So the pH of the stomach is extremely acidic. All right, it's about a pH 1, maybe even a little bit lower than 1. And that's necessary for pepsin to do its job in digesting proteins. It's very difficult to digest proteins. And the stomach also secretes intrinsic factor for the absorption of vitamin B12. And B12 is necessary for you to make red blood cells. And can you remember how many red blood cells do you have to make every second? 2.5 million? Okay, so you need a lot of that vitamin B12 in your body to make all those red blood cells. All right, and the stomach then secretes gastric juice. And when gastric juice mixes with food, we call that chyme. All right, nasty stuff. It's very what? Acidic. It's very, very acidic. All right, so the most important thing is, let's take a look at the stomach, is for storing and mixing. All right, so there is a special modification of the stomach for this particular function. All right, so this is really good. All right, so this probably is an exam figure or something very much like it. You got to know all the curvatures on the stomach. You got to probably know this cardiac sphincter here and pyloric sphincter. These are just valves or gates that make sure that once you swallow food and it becomes mixed with hydrochloric acid, that it doesn't go back up, retrograde into the esophagus and cause an esophageal ulcer, for instance. Okay? Okay, so here are the thing that the stomach does best. Notice all these folds right here. And folds usually are associated with absorption, but not necessarily so in the stomach. The stomach has all these folds so that it can expand, so that it can store food. Okay? As a matter of fact, I think I've seen a radiograph or an MRI image of somebody right after Thanksgiving, and their stomach, which was right about here, extended all the way down to their urinary bladder because they ate so much. I know you're making a really gross face. Okay? Okay? And so that's the job of the stomach. All right? So it's holding food. It's not doing a lot of digestion. What is it holding food for? Okay, well, that's because the small intestine, the next segment of the digestive tract, its function is for digestion and absorption. And when the small intestine is busy doing its job, it cannot be overloaded with anything else. And so the stomach holds that material until the small intestine is ready to receive another load of work to do. Okay? All right, so here is the stomach. You got the lesser curvature, the greater curvature, the fundus, the body of the stomach, and then the pyloric region right here, the pyloric canal, pyloric sphincter. Okay, and then the three layers of the muscularis externa. And then what's on the outside of everything? That's the serosa, right? That's the serosa, the outer layer of the stomach. And all these folds, I didn't say what they are, but what are all these folds called? Those are rugae. Yeah, those are rugae. That allows the stomach to expand. All right, so there are glands in the stomach that secrete mucus. Okay, and this is really important. Not so much for digestion, but mucus is a protein, and it's secreted by a goblet cell. And I think I had the next slide right here that shows that. All right. Okay, probably a goblet cell right here secretes mucus onto the surface of the stomach, and that's a really tough protein to digest. So mucus acts as a barrier from the activated enzymes that are in the lumen of the stomach from actually digesting the stomach away itself. So that's the important part of mucus. Not only does it act as a lubricant, but it protects the lining of the stomach from being digested. Okay. Parietal cells secrete hydrochloric acid and that intrinsic factor necessary for absorption of vitamin B12. And the chief cells secrete pepsinogen and gastric lipase. Whenever you see this term with an word with an O-gen on the end of it, like pepsinogen, I'm not sure we talked about this nomenclature yet, that means something. Does anybody know what that means? Okay. It means that, well, you know, it's normal, it's good, it's healthy and all that kind of stuff, but when you see an O-gen at the end of the word, it means that that particular compound is inactive. And pepsin is a protease, meaning that it can digest proteins. And when a cell makes pepsin, it doesn't want to make it in an active form, because what would happen to the cell that made pepsin? It would be digested away, and then it would be killed. You have this big hole in your stomach, and then a big hole in the side of your body, and all this gross stuff coming out. Okay? So the cells that, the stomach cells that make pepsin make it in an inactive form, in the form we call pepsinogen. Pepsinogen is secreted into the stomach, the lumen of the stomach, and there it's activated by the hydrochloric acid that it bumps into from the parietal cells. So the parietal and sheath cells work together to help protect the stomach from being auto-digested, but also digest material that we've eaten in kind of a nice way. Okay. All right, now what does lipase mean to you? Now, there's something at the end of this word that's an A-S-E. That means something too. O-gen means inactive. A-S-E means that it is an enzyme that can be used for digestion. And what is lipase going to digest? It's going to digest lipids. And lipids are fats. All right, so there is some lipid digestion as well in the stomach. Okay, there are also enteroendocrine cells. Entero just means digestive system endocrine cells that secrete hormones, namely gastrin, right, that get picked up by the circulatory system taken all over your body, right? And gastrin is released when the stomach starts to distend. Whenever we eat something, when the stomach stretches, that releases gastrin. All right, and so gastrin then flows back to the stomach, and it signals these parietal cells to secrete hydrochloric acid when food enters the stomach. Otherwise, those parietal cells wouldn't know what to do. So it listens for that signal. All right, so you're secreting mucus into the stomach. You're secreting intrinsic factor, hydrochloric acid, pepsinogen, and gastric lipase. All right, and other kinds of fluids, all right, and all of those things contribute to gastric juice that is secreted by your stomach. I want to finish this one thought. All right, so that's a lot of fluid that your stomach secretes into the food that you've just eaten, and that's about 1.5 liters a day. Okay, yeah. Intrinsic factor is a compound that lets you absorb vitamin B12. And vitamin B12 is necessary for you to make red blood cells. So it keeps you from going anemic. Okay? All right, so that's it. I just want you to keep track of all of the fluid that is entering the large intestine. Right? That's in the form of gastric juice. That's what? 1.5 liters a day. That's a pretty big volume. That's like 3 of those bottles right there every single day. Now, what can you tell me about fluid in your body? Is it important for you to get, do you have a lot to where you can just lose 1 liter of fluid a day? Okay, as long as I suppose you drink that much. Okay, but otherwise, no, you can't. Otherwise, you'll dehydrate. Yeah. The gastric juice certainly will irritate that ulcer, for sure, right? And it can cause an infection. As a matter of fact, probably I would say most ulcers are caused by infections, right? And for years and years and years, until maybe about 10 years ago, everybody thought that people would have ulcers due to emotional content in their life, a lot of stress, and that would produce an ulcer. Okay, but then there was a physician, I think, in Australia that said, you know what, I think I know a bacteria that's going to cause ulcers. And everybody thought he was nuts and said, no, you're wrong, it won't ever happen. And he said, well, I'm going to prove to everybody that I'm right. And he violated one of the first laws of medicine. And you know what one of the first laws of medicine is? Do no harm, don't hurt anybody. To prove a point, you can't deliberately hurt somebody and then cure them to show that, all right, you have a proper hypothesis or theory on how the world works. All right, but he said, what I'm going to do is I'm going to drink some of this bacteria, and I don't have an ulcer right now, but I bet in 3 weeks I'm going to have ulcers all over the place. And sure enough, he drank Helicobacter pylori, and he got ulcers. Okay, so he made himself sick. And then he said, now watch this. I'm going to take a bunch of antibiotics, and I'm going to kill the bacteria, and guess what's going to happen to the ulcers? The ulcers are going to go away. And he took a long course of antibiotics, and the ulcers went away, and so he proved his point. And so now everybody pretty much believes that's really a theory that bacteria can cause stomach ulcers. And so one of the first things that people do is they try to culture contents from the stomach, make sure it's an ulcer caused by bacteria, and you're put on probably a 20-day dose of antibiotics, and you can recover from that ulceration. All right, and so it had nothing to do with emotional content in somebody's life. Right, and so that's just kind of, you know, people have a tendency to fall back on that as an excuse for a lot of things or a rationale for a lot of things. And guess what we're realizing? A lot of disease processes are a result of infectious processes, right, and not other kinds of things. So it's really enhanced our understanding of pathology in people. Yeah. Was there another question that I missed? No. Okay. So, yeah, if you have ulcers, maybe it's treated very easily, just with antibiotics. Okay. Well, as you can imagine, the environment of your stomach is really, really rough because it's got all these digestive enzymes and hydrochloric acid. So there are stem cells that line the glands of the stomach that produce new gastric epithelium every 3 to 6 days. So you basically have a new lining of your stomach every 3 days. It gets rebuilt. Okay. Unless you're maybe taking some kind of chemotherapy that is blocking mitosis, right? And so what's one of the side effects that people experience when they take certain kinds of chemotherapy? Extreme gastrointestinal distress, because what's happening to their stomach and other parts of their intestine, it's made to rebuild itself every couple of days, but when you take chemotherapeutic agents, it stops, and then it just kind of gets worn down, and it becomes very irritated as a result of that. All right, so don't forget about those stem cells right there. All right, small intestine. Small intestine receives that chyme from the stomach. And what's the pH of chyme from the stomach?
One.
The pH is, acid content is?
One.
Yeah, the acid content is very high, which means the pH is really small number. It's like 0 or 1, so it's highly acidic. All right, and that could digest the small intestine. The small intestine doesn't work at that low pH. It actually works in an alkaline environment. So there have to be now other secretions that are added to that material to bring the pH back up to around pH 8. All right, so the function of the small intestine is for both digestion and absorption. So now you're going to be breaking down proteins into its building blocks. Do you know what a building block of a protein is? Probably. Yeah, they're just amino acids. What's the building block of a lipid? I wouldn't expect you to know that in this class. The building block of a lipid are fatty acids and a little glycerol molecule. And what's the building block of starch? Anybody know what the building block of starch is? It is glucose, a simple sugar. Okay. So those are all the foods that we eat. It's a job of the small intestine to break it down into those tiny building blocks. So that's digestion. The second function of the small intestine is so that you absorb those little building blocks so that you can put them together the way that your body needs them to be put together. All right, so that's a job of the small intestine. And again, what's the job of the stomach again? Storing and mixing, right, the segmentation motion, and that's why the stomach has all those layers of smooth muscle. All right, so these intestinal glands secrete about almost 2 liters of intestinal juice every day. So now how much have we secreted into our digestive tract? One, two, over 3 liters of fluid into our digestive tract for digestion. All right, that's a lot. That's what, 6 of those bottles up there. Okay, so here are the divisions. You've got the duodenum, the jejunum, and the ileum that make up the small intestine. So what does that small intestine look like? Okay, I want to come back to that slide. Well, I guess the only picture that I have of the small intestine is way back here at the beginning. Okay. So all of this right here is small intestine. So this is where the digestion and absorption takes place. The segment that's closest to the stomach is called the duodenum. The segment that is closest to emptying into the large intestine is called the ileum. And the segment that's in between, that's hard to tell where it really belongs, that's the jejunum. All right, so in lab, that's how you would recognize it as well, by the relationship to other structures. Right, if you were all experts in histology with a microscope, if I gave you a little piece of small intestine, you could tell me what part it is, but that's too difficult. So on the lab practicum, if it's close to the stomach, it's duodenum. If it's close to the large intestine, it's ileum, and if it's not close to either of those, then it's got to be jejunum. That's how you would figure that out. So food is moving by peristalsis through this whole place. Segmentation is no longer so important in the small intestine as it is in the large intestine. Okay. And, all right, so we said absorption is really important for the small intestine. There are a number of features of the small intestine that are specialized for absorption. And you should know the list of those things. All right, so here is a segment of the small intestine. And if we look, even with our naked eye, at small intestine, you see that it has all these different ribs in it, or these folds. And so we call those circular folds. Sometimes the plique circularis means what? Circular folds. So that if we were to take two ends of the small intestine, what could we do? We could change it from relatively short, and we could stretch out all those folds, and it would be a lot longer. Right? So what that is doing is that is increasing the length of the tube that increases the surface area for exchange. Right? So these plique circularis make the small intestine a lot longer, but it's folded so that it fits inside our abdominal cavity as a result of that. Okay. So that's the first thing that increases surface area for absorption. The second thing, notice that on every plique circularis, and even in between the plique, there are these very, very small finger-like projections into the lumen of the small intestine. These things are what we call villi. And they're really small, but you can just barely see them with your naked eye, and they give the surface of the small intestine like a velvety appearance. Right? And so here is a villus, right here, and there's even some smooth muscle in a villus, so they kind of wiggle around all the time inside your small intestine. And again, they act like little mixers. They mix the contents up a little bit. And that, so what we could do, not only if we were to stretch the small intestine and stretch out all of the plique circularis, but if we continue stretching and pulling, we could pull all of the villi flat as well. All those millions of villi, and now the small intestine would be what? Really, really, not flat yet, almost. Okay, because there's another fold that I want to talk about. So now the small intestine is even longer still, and that increases the surface area for absorption. Yeah, I'm going to have to think about that. I've forgotten. Okay. What's it like stretched compared to unstretched? Okay. I'll think about that. It will come back to me. I know. Okay, let me finish this lecture up. All right. But inside every villus, you have a capillary for absorption of, right, simple sugars like glucose and amino acids, but not fatty acids. Fatty acids don't get absorbed by capillary. They get absorbed by the central lymphatic capillary, and what do we call that? That's the lacteal that absorbs lipids or fatty acids. Okay. And then, of course, those all go back to your circulatory system. All right. Now, the last thing that increases the surface area is, let's zoom in to the mucosa right here. And here is just that simple columnar epithelium. And notice what kind of border this apical surface of this columnar cell has. Is it just flat, or does it have some kind of structure on the top of it? Hard to see, really hard to see with a light microscope too. It's called a brush border. Those are what we call microvilli. So these are what? Extremely small, microscopic folds on the surface of every cell. All right, so what else could we do to make the intestine even longer? We could stretch out the surface of every cell to flatten out all those thousands of microvilli on all those millions and millions of cells. So now the small intestine is what? Incredibly long. And so those are the three things that increase surface area for digestion, even though the small intestine, I believe, is only about 23 feet long. Okay? It can stretch out, I don't want to say because I forgot what the number is, probably hundreds of feet long. It's in my notes? Oh, cool. I'll go back and check my notes. All right, so what are, most importantly, let's review what those three things are that allow that incredibly long tube to fit inside your abdominal cavity. It is the plicae circularis, number one, the villi, number two, and number three is the microvilli. If all those things flatten out, what is the real length of the small intestine? All right. Oh, I don't think I give the length, but I give the surface area. All right, the surface area of the small intestine without all those folds would be about 3.5 square feet. Yeah, which is pretty big. Okay, but if we flatten out the plicae circularis, the villi, and microvilli, it turns out to be 2,200 square feet, or 47 by 47. And what's that? That's about the floor area of an average two-level house. So two levels of a house that you live in. That's the surface area for exchange, or actually really what is absorption of the small intestine. All right, so that's pretty huge. All right, so when we come back on Wednesday, I'll finish up digestive system. But don't forget about how much fluid have we put in your digestive tract already? 1.8. Yeah, almost 3. Oh, and I didn't even talk about all the spit you make every day, which is, yeah, which is, that might be about a liter as well. Okay, so add that to it. Look, do a Google on how much saliva we produce every day. 1.5 for stomach, 1.8 for small intestine, and at least a liter of saliva.